Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Jason Croft's at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. And we're very happy to have back, once again, on this program, Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at University of Illinois. And occasionally he's on the program. We always have a lot of fun when he's here talking about words and about grammar. And people have the opportunity to ask questions, usage questions. You can complain if you like. It won't do you any good, but you can complain about misuse. And we'll hear them, hear those kind of complaints. And we have talked often about language, how it changes, how stubborn it is, how resistant to change it is, and any and all of that is fine. Dennis is the author of a number of books. His most recent is A Better Pencil, Readers, Writers, and the Digital Revolution. He also has a website where he blogs about language, and that's the web of language, and there's always interesting things there to be read. And in fact, if you go there, you can, for example, read his post on the top language stories of the year 2011, and also about his thoughts on the subject of the word of the year for 2011. We'll talk about that too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Welcome back.
Well, great to be here, Dave. Right here.
Well, let's talk about the word of the year.
Okay.
This is one of those things that now people who are in the dictionary business, people who are in the language business, they like to think about the words that people have been using, the words that suddenly seem to be everywhere and say something about the spirit of the time, what people are thinking about.
The zeitgeist.
The zeitgeist. I like that word very much. That zeitgeist. And when you're here, usually we like to try to have you here around this time of the year, and that's one of the things that we talk about. So
Right. What
the word is. So for you, 2011, what's your word of the year?
Well, my word of the year was volatility. Not an exciting word, but one which I, and not particularly new, but one which I think sums up the ups and downs of 2011 in pretty much any category you can think of. Now, maybe that might apply to other years as well, but particularly in the economy, in political stuff, in stuff that's going on around the world, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of revolutionary, quasi-revolutionary activity going from one extreme to another. So that's why I picked that, and 'cause everybody's got their favorite word of the year. The American Dialect Society picked "occupy" as its word of the year, and you know that was obviously a finalist in anybody's calculation, and made a lot of impact in the last quarter of the year, and so it was on our minds, and it's like introducing a new movie just before the Oscar nominations
that's
close.
That's what you want to do.
It's
fresh in people's minds.
It's fresh in people's minds. Everybody, and, so the question is, now that the year has turned, it seems to me that, we still think about what was going on during the Occupy movement. That's kind of fizzled in terms of mentions of it. Right? I don't mean that the movement has fizzled, but the word has kind of peaked and gone back to a more modest level of usage. People are looking back fondly on the Occupy movement as good times.
Nostalgia.
Nostalgia for when you could, camp out on a public street and not freeze your what's this off?
Well, maybe it will come back when it
well,
starts
when
to get
the
warm.
Thaw. Yeah, exactly. The occupiers have migrated south, perhaps, and they will fly back in the spring.
Well, the business of the word of the year is a fun.
It's PR for the language.
Exercise.
It's PR for
and this
language.
Is a good thing. I wonder, looking back though, whether you find that words of the year end up having a permanent place, or they're words that are kind of fad words.
Yeah, well, some do, and some are very faddish, and some are very foolish. I mean, for 1 year, a few years back, I forget exactly what year the word of the year that the American Dialect Society picked was Plutoed, which that was the year that Pluto was downgraded from planetary status to the status of planetary object, what we used to call in the Captain Video days that I grew up in, a planetoid. nobody used Plutoed that year, and nobody has used it since. But you know, there you have it.
All right.
But other words of the year, like blog, certainly internet, information superhighway, those sorts of things. Yeah, they're with us. They've got a permanent place in the language.
Yeah, I was looking at one of these lists, and I came across some wag had compiled a list of fun words, and I don't know who coined it or whether it would be something that would have some legs, but the word was a Kardashian.
Oh, yes.
And a Kardashian is a unit of time. It's 72 days long, which is the length of the time that Kim Kardashian and her husband were married.
Yeah.
So, and how long will it be before people are saying, Kardashian, Kim, who's that?
Yeah, it sounds like something from Star Trek.
The Kardashians, they're bad news.
They're bad news.
They're very bad. You don't want to
They'll
get
blow up
with
your planet if you're a planetoid.
They'll marry you first, and then they'll blow up your planet.
Yeah,
and
there you go.
And there's a good prenup.
Resistance is futile.
They'll take it. You will be assimilated. That is absolutely correct. All right, very good. Well, again, questions are common. Well, they are common, and they're also welcome. And we can't promise you answers, but we can promise.
Oh, I can promise you answers, but they won't be satisfied.
You won't like them.
You won't like them.
That's what people say. We ask questions,
and he doesn't answer. Most students stay the same thing, you know.
And they're paying money.
They're paying money for it.
We don't charge to call in on the show.
No,
it's free.
This is free.
All right, 333-945.
Somebody's got to pay for it.
Toll free. Well,
yeah.
Well, please. Well, in about another 2 days, we'll be doing one. Let's just spare the people that.
Okay.
333. WILL or 9455, toll free 800-222-WILL. Among your top language stories of 2011, were there things that happened aside from the words that you thought were really interesting that were language related?
Gee.
Did you remember having written this?
I wrote this post a month or so ago. Yeah. What are some of my
It was so I mean, last year.
Yeah, so last year.
Hmm.
I mean, you've got some things that you know, you've got Arab Spring
I think a lot of people thought, you know, that would be one of their finalists for Word of the Year.
Yeah.
I
mean,
just because of, or like Tsunami.
Tsunami.
Meltdown.
Meltdown. You know, all these things are related to news items, okay? But the question then becomes... At some point, some of these words, as you put it, have legs. Some of them have some kind of longevity, some kind of creative power where they get applied to other sorts of situations as well. So one of the ones that, to give you an example that will take you back a little bit, is gate. The suffix for Watergate, back in the heady days of the Nixon administration, Watergate became synonymous with some kind of political scandal, hanky-panky and wrongdoing. And Watergate is actually the name of a building, okay, in D.C. And the suffix gate sort of broke free from that name and started to be applied in over a 20 or 30-year period every time there was something scandalous, first political scandals, but then, you know, even a little bit more general, scandalous kinds of hanky-panky things. You had all kinds of gates. That sort of faded out now, but every once in a while something breaks and somebody attaches, news anchor will attach a gate to it.
Just this week we were talking about Pakistani politics.
Okay. So.
And there's a thing going on now. This is maybe a couple of months old, but there was an anonymous memo that came out and that were purported to be an appeal from the government of Pakistan to the government of the United States asking for support because the government of Pakistan was afraid that there might be a military coup.
Right.
And this was referred to, I guess, in the Pakistani press and in the world press as Memogate.
Memogate.
Memogate. So that's still that gate. Still works.
Okay, so it still works. It still works.
We have some callers here. Why don't we talk with them? Well, let's go over to Indiana. How about that? Line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Oh, two things. I wondered if you could repeat his website. My radio went, and I never got to hear anything.
Yeah, that's exactly
that's the name of the website.
That's
actually the name of the website, but it's actually spelled Web of Language.
Web of Language?
Yeah, you just Google that, and it will come up. You can also follow me on Twitter at Dr. Grammar.
Oh, wow. Second thing, if these kind of words, one of which I will mention shortly, have a particular name, I'd like to know what it is, and also talk about how their lasting effect has been around a long time. I'm talking about the word cool. First time I heard it was in the late 40s.
Cool.
Dealt with jazz.
Yes.
Now, with these young kids, everything's cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes I'd say, what the hell are you talking about, man? I mean, what's cool about that? And they looked at you like,
cool.
Oh, you're fossil fodder, man. And I just wonder if you talk about words such as cool, and
okay.
If there are any others. Thank you.
Well, that's a great example, because I actually use cool in my class. When we talk about slang or informal language use, one of the common conceptions of slang is that it is tends to be extremely informal, and also tends to be fairly volatile in the sense that it's here today, gone tomorrow. Somebody uses a slang expression, and at a certain point, it gets sort of worn out, and somebody comes up with an alternative to it. Okay, because it no longer has that sort of éclat that you associate with slang, that kind of strikingness, that kind of, hey, you know, that sort of define. Sometimes slang is used to define a group, the people who know what the slang expression means as opposed to those who are on the outside and saying what's all that about. But sometimes it's just a, you know, a highly informal aspect to language. Now, cool sort of goes against some of those stereotypes of slang, because it is still identified as slang, even though it does go back to the 40s, possibly even earlier. Cool jazz, in the context of cool jazz, is the follow-up to hot jazz. Okay, it's what followed hot jazz and kind of bebop, Dixieland sort of stuff. And really, I associate it more with the 50s in terms of musical movements. But it's one of those words that has persisted in the slang repertoire in English. It is, you don't find it in formal writing typically. You find it in conversation or in writing that captures dialogue or the vernacular language. That's cool, man. Cool. And it's a word that didn't quite die out. It didn't quite get replaced, and it's kind of persisted. It's like I tell the students, you know, it's like clothing fashion. You're not ready to give this to the Goodwill. If you get tired of it, put it back in the closet, because a couple years later it'll be back, and you can take it out and use it again. Mm-hmm. So there is that aspect to slang. I mean, take a word like mob, a word like boss. Those originated as slang terms. They are still relatively informal, particularly something like boss. The more formal term would be employer or supervisor or something like that. But boss is a very common word in our language even today, and it's kind of slangy rather than the other end of the formality spectrum. Mm. So what do you call these words? They are slang words, but they're examples of the kind of slang that persists rather than the kind of slang that's ephemeral, that's gone like that, like a snap of the finger.
And you can't predict whether something's going to last or not.
You can't predict it. It's got to be retrospective. You collect the data and you see what the patterns of usage are. And that's, you know, nice thing about the new technologies is that they allow us to collect huge, huge amounts of both written and spoken language data and all levels of the formal, informal spectrum, mm-hmm. all kinds of markers of, you know, kinds of people who say this or kinds of people who say that or kinds of occasions when it's said, and so on. So we can analyze huge, huge, you know, multi-million word databases of usage to see what the actual patterns are and how that matches with our informal perception of how the language is going. We actually can quantify some of that.
Yeah. That's
it's really cool.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, that's I guess that back in the day there was a point where the only really the thing that you had to see what words people were using when they first appeared was when something first appeared in print.
Exactly. And you know, when you look at historical language data, you're pretty much confined to what gets written down, and not just that, but what gets written down and gets preserved. Because, you know, the assumption is once you put it in writing, it's there forever. But writing gets lost just as speech does. Okay, so what kinds of things get written down? There's a lot of stuff that doesn't get written down. What kinds of things that you write down actually get preserved? You don't typically preserve your shopping lists or your business memos or things like that. You preserve things that have some value culturally, socially, whatever, or personally. And some of those things get lost by accident as well, even if you try to preserve them. Written stuff can be volatile in terms of, you know, paper dries up, gets brittle, gets burnt, gets wet, you spill coffee on it, whatever.
Yeah.
Gets lost.
Dennis Barron is here with us this morning. Occasionally he's on the program. We talk about words, language, grammar, questions are welcome, complaints, whatever is on your mind has to do with language.
The doctor is in.
They call him Dr. A.K.A. Dr. Grammar. It's one of his aliases.
That's my Twitter handle.
That's his Twitter handle. So, unfortunately, we cannot accept tweets, but calls and emails we can do. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222.
You mean this station does not have a Twitter feed?
Well, we do some stuff with tweets.
You tell me Brighton doesn't do this?
I don't. Well, yeah, and we have a guy. We have a kid. We have a kid.
Oh, don't get all generational on me.
I just don't get this Twitter thing. I don't get it.
You don't
I
get it?
I just don't get it.
Oh, yeah. You kids get off my lawn.
No, exactly. Yes, that's me. That is me. Yes. Oh, yes, my friend. That is me. Get out, you kids get off my lawn. No, I don't get it.
You're standing here looking at a computer monitor.
Well, that's I sort of get internet. Okay. I can get email. I get that. A lot of this other stuff, I don't get it. I don't have a smartphone. I ain't smart enough. I don't get it. I have a little cell phone. I never turn it on. That's just me.
Okay.
You know, so
you are like that.
Yeah.
You are like that.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I'm sorry to hear
sort
that.
Of.
I'm sorry to hear that. I thought you were cooler than that.
No, I am not. I've never been cool ever. So it's just.
I've always been a nerd. I have never been cool, but I have a Twitter feed.
Yeah. Oh, well. But, well, no, I know. You're a cutting edge
kind
of guy.
No, I don't write what I had for breakfast on it. I mean, this is for professional use. Talk about language, talk about technology, talk about education issues, the kinds of things that I do on my blog reduced to 140 characters.
So it's a good challenge, having to say something in 140 characters.
It's like a digital haiku.
Yes. Yes. And we do tweet the topic of the – actually, Harriet Williamson tweets the topic of the show every day. She's responsible for reducing my blather to 140 characters.
Really?
And, you know, maybe that would be good for me to actually to have to do that, to encapsulate the topic of the show in 140 characters. But I don't get it, so I don't do it.
Okay.
Yeah. I do have an email here from someone who would like to have your comments on two of their pet peeves, now in common usage. Peeve number one.
It's like Dr. Seuss.
Peeve number one, the exact same thing. We have heard people say that. Oh, that's the exact same thing. Isn't that a double positive?
Okay. Is it a double positive? The exact thing, the same thing?
The exact same
thing. I suppose. So what? So what if it's a double positive? You know, there's this, the philosopher, was it Sidney Morgan Besser or something like that? There's a story about him, I think it was he, that there was this meeting and somebody was saying, all languages, you know, can have double negatives and double negative can sometimes be a positive. And sometimes it's double negative, it's simply a more intensive negative, but there's no such thing as a double positive being a negative. And I think it was Morgan Besser again, who maybe was somebody else, the caller can call in and correct me, piped up from the back of the room and said, yeah.
It's just a matter if it's a matter of intensifying.
It's
your
an
point.
Intensifier, exactly. People don't like aspects of language, but so what? You know, everybody's got stuff they hate about language, and that doesn't tend to impact other users. People are going to use the exact same thing. If you're trying to write a tweet and you want to shorten it to fit into the 140 character space, then you might think about cutting some of this excess verbiage out. But language is full of extra words. We that tells me we sort of think we need them.
All right.
They have a function.
Thing number two.
Yes.
Peeve number two. Gonna have to.
Gonna have to.
In place of need. The person writes, I have seen national broadcasters say this when reading from a teleprompter. Surely.
You mean he or she has heard
he
it.
He or she has.
You don't see it. You
there
hear
you
it.
Go. There you go.
But of course you see
yes,
it.
Yes, they
you
have observed it. National broadcasters say this when reading from a teleprompter. Surely they did not write that in a script. And I cannot believe that they would have written gonna have to into their copy and have read that off a teleprompter. But I suppose that's possible.
So this is a peeve because what? I mean, this is why I like to have people actually on the line, because then you can have some back and forth. Why don't you like it? That's what I want to know.
Extreme informality, sloppiness, lack of discipline.
Too many words is my guess. If you would prefer saying it, going to have to, the alternative is need. I need to, and so my guess is this writer thinks it's saying it in too many words. There's lots of ways to get from A to B in the English language. And it's not concise. Sure, it's not concise, going to have to do this. But it certainly is idiomatic. It certainly sounds okay when people say stuff like that. It sounds like you're having a normal English conversation. Mm-hmm. It's an alternative to I need to, but, is it... I don't know, maybe a little less blunt. You're going to have to do this rather than you need to do this. It's a little bit more indirect. I don't know. It's a little softening the imperative, the futurity of it. Maybe it seems to have a stylistic purpose is all I'm driving at here. That people who use it think of it, don't necessarily make a conscious choice. It just sort of flows naturally, and it's an option. It's an option, and you have the option to not like it. I'm not objecting to our emailer's dislike of it. I'm just saying, okay, what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can walk around with a placard on the street saying, stop using, gonna have to.
You're gonna have to stop using that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, okay, so... back in the day, last time I was in an English class, I don't know when it was. I'm sure
for me it was yesterday.
Well, I know for you it was just yesterday, and particularly I suppose I'm thinking of the kind of message that you would get in grade school, where the teacher would try to get across the idea that there's formal communication and there's informal communication.
Yeah.
There's the way you talk with your friends, and there's the way you go talk when you're out on a job interview.
Okay, but that's oversimplifying things. All of my students tell me this. There's formal and there's informal.
Okay.
But think about, what do you mean by formal? How many times in your life do you have a job interview? How formal are job interviews? I mean, aren't you supposed to be kind of relaxed and comfortable and show that you can handle the pressure?
Good point. Yes, I suppose.
Aren't you supposed to not seem stuffy and pedantic
or
at a job interview?
The sweat shouldn't be pouring off of you.
Unless you're applying for the job of pedant.
Is there work for pedants?
I don't know.
In today's
because,
world?
Help wanted pedant. I'll look on Craigslist.
Okay. All right.
It's up there on the X-rated part of Craigslist, I think. This is a very stigmatized profession.
I think you may be confusing that with something else, but I'm not exactly sure.
No. I'm saying it's a negative stigma for peasant. Okay. Pedant, not peasant. Peasant, no.
No, don't say peasants. Anything about the peasants.
Peasants, no. We're back in the Middle Ages
in
here.
Trouble
peasants.
Now. All right. One more, and then I have a caller here. Also, the emailers are concerned. You're not done?
We have
a third peeve. Not listed as such, but if you would clarify, people often say they graduated college.
Ah, yes.
Is this correct, or is it graduated from college?
Well, graduate, this is interesting. There's a usage thing going on with graduate. The debate used to be, could you graduate from college, or did the college graduate you? Who's doing what to whom? And so to graduate college is simply you're dropping the preposition off. And it's become idiomatic. You don't have to like it. To graduate, I think I would say graduate from, or I graduated.
Yeah, all right. I think I would say graduated from. Yeah. I think I would,
yeah.
But.
Yeah, did the student say I graduated the University of Illinois, or did you graduate from the university? I don't know. But yeah, you hear graduated college from time to time. It's a kind of shortcut. And yeah, maybe you don't like it. Maybe I wouldn't say it. But I don't know. You know, I'm guessing that I probably don't say that. But certainly I hear plenty of people who do. And yeah, it can be a usage issue. People discriminate make distinctions based on, you know, the kind of language choices you make. The old radio commercial used to be with this ominous voice, people judge you by the words you use. And it was an ad for cassette tapes to improve your vocabulary.
Indeed.
Yeah. You don't remember that.
No.
They used to carry it on the Chicago radio stations, those all news stations like WBBM, I think. That outfit is still in business. But they're on the web now. And they sell a CD instead of a cassette tape. But it's still a vocabulary improvement. But the minatory warning. Tone.
You know,
people judge you by the words you use. Mm. That's like their trademark slogan. Mm.
We have some emails. We have a caller. And I tell you what, if I can indulge, this person will indulge me on the phone just one real quick second. We need to take a break. And then we'll continue. This is Focus, back after a short break.
Rhythm and blues performer, songwriter, and producer Johnny Otis has died at the age of 90. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our 1989 interview with Otis. He was a white performer who loved black culture and considered himself black by persuasion. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And also, I'm happy to have you here in studio with me, Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois. Occasionally is on the program. We talk about language. He's authored a number of books. You might take a look at them, including his most recent, A Better Pencil, Readers, Writers, and the Digital Revolution. You can also look at his website, The Web of Language. Questions welcome. And there's someone who's been very patient with me. I will get right to them in Aurora. Line 4. Hello.
Yes, hello. I enjoy the show today. First, I got to ask you, Dennis, you don't have to be exact, but how old are you?
I am 60-something.
Okay. Well, good, because when you said you were a nerd, I had this picture of you when I was in high school in the 60s.
That's me. That's me.
Coming down the steps of that slide rule.
The slide rule, yes.
On the thigh there, because you had it hooked onto your belt, right?
You betcha.
Yep, I had that vision of you as soon as you mentioned that. So
I may have had a pocket protector. I don't remember.
And I do remember those commercials you were talking about how people judge you by the words you use.
Yeah.
You know, when my son was in grade school, I remember one of his teachers telling me that what the spelling of donut, D-O-N-U-T, was starting to be acceptable spelling. And I didn't even think about it.
Right.
Where, you know, D-O-U-G-H.
Right.
But we've been bombarded with the shortened version for so long that we just kind of think it's common.
It is common.
It wasn't always that way, though.
No, it wasn't always that way. You know, sinkers used to be spelled D-O-U-G-H, not... and the slang term for them was sinkers, because you would dip them in your coffee, right?
Oh, see, I never called them sinkers.
Yeah. I never did either, but it was,
I guess if you
it was before our time.
Well, if you leave them in the coffee too long, they will definitely sink. But
well, yeah.
But what I did call about today is that when is the proper usage of me and I?
Well...
Sure. Is it Jack and I, or is it Jack and me? And you know, is there a simplified?
It depends. I mean, this is complicated. You got to put it into a bigger context than that.
Okay.
So, me is technically speaking, it's the object form of the pronoun, and I is the subject form of the pronoun. So, typically, things that go before the verb are subjects, and things that go after the verb are objects. Things that go after a preposition are objects. But me and I gets some variant usage. So, for example, you knock on somebody's door and they say, "Who is it?" And you say, "What?"
"It is I."
You say, "It is I." But a lot of people just say, "It's me." I mean, this is assuming that the person knows who you are, is
right.
Sort of expecting you kind of thing. Otherwise, you would announce your name or, you know, say that you have a warrant or something like that, right? Knock and announce. So most people say it's me. They wouldn't want to say it is me. They say Smee as if it were, you know.
Smee. Isn't he a character in Peter Pan?
Peter Pan, yeah. Okay, so the other thing, I mean, it's a little less formal. It's a little more intimate, maybe even. So the other thing is the between you and I idiom, which is maybe what you're driving at, when the X plus first person singular pronoun, Harry and me, Harry and I. You tend to get a lot of speakers, a lot of careful speakers, educated speakers of English, people who evince concern for good language. Good language. Say they gave it. You know, I'm trying to think of a good example. He gave it to Harry and I. Technically, it should be Harry and me, but we have this sort of avoidance behavior of me. Some people say it's because of this kind of indoctrination in school, where teachers say, you know, me and him went to the store. No, don't say that. It's
He
and I went to the store. Okay, so they port that over to the object form as well, because there's some kind of stigma for X plus me in the language. But it has become now, whatever the reason is, it's become kind of idiomatic to use X plus I after a preposition. Technically wrong, but if enough people do it, it's technically right. Because meaning trumps grammar every single time. That's one of Barron's rules of usage. And the way the language behaves is that grammar's like a stop sign. It's a guideline. It's not categorical unless the cop is watching.
but I'm always...
Okay.
I guess
you're the grammar cop, okay. But, yeah, there are certain situations where we may be more careful. But people who say, give it to Harry and I, are never going to say, give it to Harry and he.
That's true.
They say, give it to Harry and him. Okay, so they will use the object form appropriately after preposition. In lots of cases, except for that first person singular.
Well, now I'm totally confused.
They won't say give it to them and we. They'll say give it to them and us as well. So, but they will say give it to him and I. Give it to Harry and I.
Okay.
So that suggests it's become an idiom. An idiom. We don't analyze idioms grammatically. They're treated as sort of, you know, blocks of usage that you don't look too closely at. Okay, they don't follow. In other words, they're sort of exempted from the grammar rules that other things apply to. So there's the issue with the me and I that I think you're driving at, that it's complicated and it's been moving in that X plus I direction probably for 20, 30 years,
okay.
maybe even a little more.
Because the English language is a strange language.
It is strange and it is ever changing and it is healthy and it is vibrant and creative and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, we try to push it around, we try to manipulate it, and it seems to have a mind of its own too, as well. It's hard to take control over it and say this should be this way and this should be that way. It just keeps going on.
But I always cringe, as I mentioned earlier, when I hear people talk about me and Jack or me and Jill or something.
Sure, sure.
And I've heard some very well-educated people that, you know, I've had many years of taxpayer-subsidized education using that using that particular words, you know, or phrase.
And many years as a taxpayer, too, and seeing your money go to waste. your federal tax dollars at work.
That's right.
You know, there you go. But, you know, what's your take on who and whom, too, you know? That's people have been predicting the death of whom for 200-300 years,
and it keeps
popping back.
Yes, when you use that, it people kind of does startle people
because
they're kind of like, whoa, where's this guy coming from?
So. Yeah, well, you know, the examples are you can't say for who the bell tolls; you have to say for whom.
Very good.
On the other hand. Maybe you remember Johnny Carson's first daytime quiz show was called Who Do You Trust? And my comment there is you wouldn't find a TV program called Whom Do You Trust even on PBS.
On the BBC.
Even on the BBC, maybe in the 1950s, not today.
Yeah. Oh, well,
today.
That's probably right. I want to thank you for the call. I have some other folks here.
Who do you trust, mate?
I do also want to, for the record, as they used to say on CBC, I do have an email here from my producer, Harriet Williamson, one of the most important people to me in the world, reminded me that the program gets tweeted 4 times a day, explanation point, and she's the one who does it. So there we go.
There you go. Well, what's the handle?
I have no idea. I told you. I don't get it.
At will, right?
I don't get it.
That's funny. At will.
Yeah, she does it
at will.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Nothing personal. Here's an email from someone says, nothing personal, but this show makes me want to cut my wrists. Great programming 98% of the time.
Well, nothing personal. I don't take it personally.
All right. Grammar question here. Another grammar question. I was privy to a gaggle full of adolescent girls while visiting a couple I know. During the conversation, a remark made by someone was greeted with, oh, that's so random. I have since confirmed with someone who has a young niece who used the same expression. Do you happen to know how the expression has entered the language? Has someone famous for that peer group, like Justin Bieber, for example, and if you know who he is, you must have young people in your life, or someone, do you know anything about
him?
Have you heard that?
I haven't heard Just So Random. I have to ask my 10-year-old niece.
I'm not even quite sure what exactly that means.
That is just so
that
random.
Something's just so random.
Yeah.
That it's unexpected?
I don't know. That sounds too literal. That's so random. Is that like, you know, the sequel to That's So... I don't know.
Someone will have to call in and tell who knows about that expression, say, what does that mean that something is so random?
Yeah.
That's new to me.
Let's get a hold of some middle schoolers here.
Good point.
They will answer this question.
Here's another email. Please give a moment of silence for the death of the word fewer. Less has gobbled it up.
No. As my son sent me an email photo, he was at Whole Foods yesterday evening doing his shopping in Chicago, and he sent me the email from the express lane at Whole Foods, which says 10 items or fewer.
Whoa.
And it's probably only groceries, because this is organic language, right? This is organic English. 10 items
or fewer. That's whole wheat English right there.
That's whole, this is good for you, right? This will keep you regular. I don't know. Everybody says 10 items or less, all the express lanes. And I have to say that in the old days, I've been at the UFI a long time. There used to be a Jewel, which is a grocery store chain on Green and Neal. It's now just an Osco, but there used to be a Jewel grocery store there. And I was there once stopping and noticed that on the express lane at that particular Jewel, and this was before we had digital cameras and stuff like that, or I would have memorialized it, someone had taken the trouble to climb up on the checkout belt and correct 10 items or less, and with a black marker, crossed out the less and wrote in handwriting, fewer. And I'm thinking, only in an academic community like this are you going to see something like that. Now we've got Whole Foods with actual printed signs. I bet you don't see this at Trader Joe's. I don't think Trader Joe's has express lanes anyway. But
very well. Let us continue. By the way, we have about 10 minutes left with Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois. We're talking about language here. And hopefully no one has done any damage to themselves listening to this show. if it gets to that point, just turn it off.
Yeah. Seek professional help if this is a life-threatening emergency. Yeah, right. As they say, dial 911.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't call us because we can't help you.
We won't help you.
We'll
only make it worse.
There may be a Good Samaritan rule that we would have to step in and take some action, but
The only action I can think of would just be to put on some nice music, something that would be soothing.
Can you repair a split infinitive?
You're the doctor. I'm not licensed to practice in this state. Line number one. This is a caller here at Champaign County. Champaign County, hello.
Hi. Let me take you off speaker.
Hi.
I haven't listened from the very beginning. Indeed, did you cover the fact that at least one of the groups that sees fit to do this thing for Word of the Year picked Occupy?
Yes.
And American Dog
Society. A number of people, I think, did.
There were others. The interesting thing is that the Oxford Dictionaries group picked Squeezed Middle as not just the Word of the Year, but the global English Word of the Year. It is a word that is used in England to I think liberal politicians.
I think the labor leader
Miliband.
Ed Miliband
used Squeezed Middle, although he may not have coined it. I think it was in the discourse to refer to the middle class that was being pressured by spiraling prices and a down market economy and job loss and all these pressures somebody pointed out hardly a global word of the year if nobody outside of England has heard of it, and certainly not widespread even in England.
Well, I wanted to see if I'm still on here.
Yes.
Whether I can mention that there's an Occupy the Courts event over at Elmen Vine, I guess.
Too cold
to come out, blow your horn when you're driving by over the noon hour. And the other thing I wanted to ask about is, have you looked at Amitav Ghosh's Lashkiri Origin of English Words? That it's befuddling to me. I don't know whether it's a Joycean prank, this Presto, he's got a glossary in his first book. Have you looked at that stuff? River?
No. I think I've read one or part of one of his books, but I'm not familiar with the list you're talking about.
Ah, well.
What's the idea?
Is there a specific?
Well, the idea is that English is a funny language, and one of the ways that the British Empire and its conquest of India affected language acquisition, the word appropriation. Pajamas is an Hindi word, and there were some. He's making a case that the Lashkiris were the seamen for the Indian Empire before it got colonized, were the people that transported the words, and he just sees this amazing pattern. But like I say, the glossary, I've only looked at a cursory, where he tries to sort of show this, is very hard to get one's mind around, so I don't know. The River of Smoke refers to the opium trade,
right,
the English
right.
Empire's use of that, and it's not a major part of the impetus for the book, but it underlies it, and it's all very complicated. So,
well, certainly English has borrowed a lot of words in the course of its very long history, and one of the input sources for new words in the 19th century certainly was the British colonial empire. That not only were they, you know, taking natural resources from countries around the world and using them to feed the British industrial machine, but also taking words and growing the English vocabulary. And yeah, you get words like pajama and juggernaut and so on. A lot of empire-related word use. And now you know, the tide has turned a little bit, and English is a major exporter of words to other languages as well. And this is sometimes perceived as a new kind of linguistic imperialism.
Franglais, for instance, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, some like the French, try to take protectionist measures to slow this down or prevent it from happening, not very successfully. Other countries are a little bit more open to, other cultures are a little more open to borrowing from English, but it's a natural consequence of the prominence of the U.S. In the 20th and 21st centuries and the sort of cultural dominance of first England and then the U.S. And in terms of global capitalism, as well as, you know, the impact of technology, science, and rock and roll.
Okay. Well, we haven't revisited the French Academy's attempt to change the gender of English in a while. I discovered it in a footnote I was reading. They tried to make it loto blanc instead of loto blanche. So it just shows what you can do if you're in a Royal Academy of scholars, I guess. Not much.
Not right. much, because it doesn't impact ordinary French usage, typically, anyway.
I want to thank the caller, and also wanted to talk with someone here. We have someone who has some insight into So Random here
great.
On our line number 4. Can you tell us what that means, what So Random means?
Sure. So random is a slang, which means like unexpectedly great or really good.
Mm.
I think it stems from a Lady Sovereign song, which was a British rapper song in the last few years. And I get kids use it. And it's really interesting how kids come up with their own language, I think, to confuse older people like us in some ways and to communicate between themselves. So I think this is a really nice example of that.
Oh, so it's something really good that happens, but that is totally unexpected.
So it's a positive term, yeah.
Well, originally it was part of the song Get Random, which meant lose inhibition. I think it went from that to meaning unexpectedly great, and now it means just kind of really great. So people use it in different forms. But yeah, it's taken on this connotation of being really wonderful.
Okay, so that's replaced that so sick, where sick is a positive term.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, that's excellent. That's so random that she called in and told us about that. We'll try to get one more caller in, and we try to take people in order. So I think
140 characters. Let's go. We'll tweet the next two
we'll
calls.
Tweet the next
Here
two
we
calls.
Go.
Champagne line 2, I think.
This is our version of speed dating.
Hello.
Finally. First, I want to say I do not flip my wrist. I think this is really funny. Second, I want to say that as far as colonial English, as George Bernard Shaw said, in America, they haven't spoken it for years.
I think that was actually Rex Harrison. But
I think it was Henry Higgins, yes. But maybe that comes out of Pygmalion.
Well, I don't know if it's a line from Pygmalion. It's certainly a line from My Fair Lady.
It originally,
okay.
But anyway,
okay. Well, we can check that out.
And then I've found that calling a person you don't know and asking for her, usually it's her for me, mm-hmm. by first name, people under 30 tend to say, "This is." May I speak to Julia? This is.
Or just this is,
me,
not as.
Well, I, not that, as it's me.
Or speaking.
Speaking. Yeah. This is.
This is. Hmm.
And
I haven't heard that.
As far as educated people, I notice now a lot of educated people, since more and more people are being educated to the bachelor's level mm-hmm. and come from different backgrounds, there's a lot of people who use I should have did it, I should have went, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I've found that a lot of people use that, which is, that sort of bugs me, but, mm-hmm. you know, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do?
So well, those are my comments.
I thank you for the comments. And anything to say about that?
Yeah, I don't know. It would bother me, I suppose, but certainly it depends on the context.
All right.
If it was in an application to graduate school, you know, I don't think that would work too well. But
do you ever have the urge to correct people?
I do.
And then do you follow through?
I do. It's a kind of Dr. Strangelove thing where you have to keep trying to hold that hand down from saluting.
Yes. Yes,
of course.
Indeed.
Of course I do. Yes. Of course I do. Everybody does. Everybody does. But you have to figure out when it's appropriate and when it's just gauche.
All right. One more call. We'll try here. Line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I was just going to leave you with a line. Nothing personal, but this show just makes me chuckle through the whole thing. I love the thing with the less and fewer on the checkout line. Also, my teenager uses random, not in a positive way. I can't really give you the definition of it, but it seems like it's something lame rather than something good.
Okay, that's interesting. Because
that's all I got. Thanks.
All right, thank you. So can there be something that simultaneously and at the same time
yes.
has these two opposite? People are using it in these two very different ways.
It's very common to flip a positive to a negative or vice versa. Yeah, yeah.
We're at just about the point we're going to have to finish mercifully, I'm sure, for some of the listeners. In the meantime, if you'd like to read some of
I'm sorry, your 140 characters are up.
That's
please deposit another
what
25 cents.
What are you going to say in 140 characters? Really? That's the problem.
Read my tweets.
I'm sure it's a good, you know, it's a good little discipline. Like you said, it was a haiku.
Read my tweets.
All right. Yes. Read Dennis's tweets. You can go to his website, The Web of Language, and read more of his musings on language. You can also look for some of his books. The most recent is A Better Pencil, Readers, Writers, and the Digital Revolution.
Yes, Oxford
he is
University Press.
Professor of English and Linguistics at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome.